So it's been a few weeks since we've been in the book of James. We've had Easter, and then last week we had the Faust presenting. And then next week, Dottie is going to be sharing with us about her work. And then the week following, I believe, is Brad Wass is going to be sharing with us. So here I am right in the middle of these weeks, and it's like, should I get back into James, or should I hold off? And but I just felt like I needed to be back in the book of James, and it was good to study James again this week. So we're going to be in James chapter 4, if you want to turn there. We're also going to be, you should have a sermon outline. I think there should be enough that everyone got one. There's a couple other texts, you might want to flip over those. Matthew, is it 25, and Luke chapter 12. We're going to be in those later on. James 4 is our primary text, a few verses in there. And I do always have the verses on the screen. But there's something about following along in the Word. I want to refresh our memories a little bit from where we left off in James chapter 4. James 4 addresses a very common problem in James's day, as well as it is still today. You may have realized that there is fighting in the church. Now, of course, not our church. It's all another church's, right? Not today, at least. But James addresses this issue. Now, I had originally, when I first looked at this, I kind of seen all of chapter 4 as dealing with that. But as I began to study a little further down and get into that, I began to see that, in fact, as he gets to verse 13, there's something else going on. And part of what caused me to see that was a connection between verses 13 of chapter 4 and verse 1 of chapter 5. I had to rethink my original approach to that. The repetition of the phrase, "come now," in both places is hard to ignore as a clue that there's a relation between these two statements, these two paragraphs, one at the end of chapter 4 and the other at the beginning of chapter 5. So I see these two "come now" warnings as related broadly to personal finance. Now, I said broadly, okay? Because there's more to it than just that, but that is certainly included in both of these references. The first warning, which is all we're going to look at today, hones in on not bragging about your future financial plans. But really, it does go much deeper than that. That's kind of the overall concept that's of this first warning. But within this, we're going to find some other principles as well. But first of all, we need to recognize that James is giving us here a very solemn warning. He says in verse 13 of James 4, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit." Now, James wrote, "Come now, you who say," as a way of indicating two things. First of all, it's a transition. It's a recognition, hey, I'm transitioning to something else here. But secondly, it's something that gets the attention of the reader. He's about to give a very grave and solemn warning to those who either say or have an attitude expressed in the following hypothetical declaration: "Today or tomorrow, we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit." That was common in James's day for enterprising people. Now remember, James was talking to Jews and Jewish Christians in particular. That was his audience, right? Spread throughout the Roman Empire. And so it was very common for them to head off to one of the great centers of trade and merchandise in the Roman Empire, or perhaps in Alexandria in Egypt, and they would set up business for a period of time, and they would make good money at it, right? It might be something like in our own day, the aspiring actress who heads off to Hollywood to get her big break in acting. Or perhaps the hopeful athlete who devotes his life to sports, expecting to compete at a level to make his fortune. Perhaps more to our speed, many a young man has headed off to the oil fields of, say, Oklahoma or Texas or someplace there in the plains. And it's interesting because that's normally a one-year commitment that they make. And they go there and they make good money. Has anyone here done that? Okay, I've known some of the kids we've worked with over the years have done that very thing. They've gone off to Oklahoma and they've made really good money. And they come back with all this stuff. Really, it's no money to show for, but all the stuff at least. And so I think James has touched on a topic for the American who sees the myriad of opportunities to gain wealth and amass more stuff that should strike a nerve with every single one of us. Because chances are we've all kind of had this mindset at some point in our lives. Whether it was when we were younger or throughout our entire lives, we've probably had this same kind of idea. Surely for the Jewish Christians James addressed, it was similar. Before we jump to the conclusion that James is about to condemn the entrepreneurial spirit that drives people to succeed in life, we need to read the next sentence to see where he's going. Verse 14. James says, "Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes." Now James doesn't condemn the drive to build a successful business or to excel at a skill that could benefit you financially. This is strictly a warning about planning on that success. It's a warning to remember that your life is short, and maybe much shorter than you expect. Some of you know firsthand that a heart attack or a stroke can drastically change all your plans in an instant. A car accident or other tragedy can alter the course of your life without warning. You're not guaranteed to even walk out of this room, much less that something won't happen tonight that interrupts your plans for success a year from now. So does this mean we're to make no plans for the future? No plans for tomorrow? Are we sinning every time we make up a church calendar of planned ministry opportunities? We must be careful of inferring more from the text than James intended to convey. James has only said, "You do not know what tomorrow will bring." Now, he does imply that you should not expect to live another day with the statement that your life is a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. It is indeed a poignant reminder of the brevity of life. But to assume that James means for us to make no plans at all for the future is to go too far. That's part of the mistake we see in Jesus' parable of the talents. So now, if you've got your fingers in Matthew 25, that's where we're going to be now. We're going to read a significant portion of Scripture, Matthew 25, 14 to 31. Matthew places Jesus delivering this parable as part of his last teaching before his betrayal and crucifixion. He's giving his disciples last-minute instructions before he leaves the earth, before his crucifixion. He's prepping them to take the mantle, to have a longer view of things now. And you need to be faithful stewards of what God gave them. So Jesus gave them this ominous warning about not being so paralyzed by fear of the future that you do nothing at all. Matthew 25, 14, Jesus says, "For it will be like a man going on a journey, who has called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. And then he went away." But we can stop there and go, "Well, that's interesting. Why would someone do that?" Is that kind of the question? That should be. It probably is the question that immediately runs through your mind. Why would someone do this? Okay, keep that question in mind. Let's read on. Verse 16. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. So also he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Verse 19. Now after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here, I've made 5 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And he also, who had the 2 talents, came forward saying, Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I have made 2 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. Now, put that in perspective here. This first guy, he delivers 5 talents more. He delivered 2.5 times more than the second servant did, right? But both servants get the same reward. They're both praised for being good and faithful servants. They both double the investment. And you'll know the story, of course. He comes to the final one. He also, who had received the 1 talent, came forward saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid. And I went and I hid your talent in the ground. Here, have what is yours. Was he expecting a pat on the back for that? I mean, he just said, I knew that you gathered where you hadn't sown. And I knew that's what you did. But I went and hid your talent. Are you an idiot? I mean, really. He has just convicted himself. He has just said, this is what you do. You make money where you don't even plant anything. He said, you gave this money because you expected me to plant it. I hid it. Aren't you proud of me? What's wrong with this guy? Which explains why, verse 26, his master answered him, You wicked and slothful servant! You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scattered no seed. He just said that. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has will more be given, and he will have in abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So, James has talked about not knowing what tomorrow would bring. And we might want to say from that, well, then we better be very, very careful, not do anything, may not plan on tomorrow. Well, that's the approach this third servant took. He made no plans whatsoever for tomorrow. I'm just going to bury this talent. And so, clearly, the what James is telling us cannot be, don't do anything. Because that's what Jesus has addressed here. Now, obviously, Jesus' teaching was in a different context than James's. The large sums of money each servant received represent more than the financial resources God gives to each of us. Your natural, God-given talents, your spiritual gifts, your physical and financial resources, all of these are given to you by God. That wealthy master in this parable, who has seemingly unlimited resources, he's given them to you with the expectation that you will invest them. That means you must look to the future and do something with the resources God has given you. He expects you to not sit around doing nothing and will hold you responsible for your failure to engage in the work of life, both physically and spiritually. So you can't use James's warning about not knowing what tomorrow will bring as an excuse for laziness. God will punish that. Remember, Jesus said, "For to everyone who has will more be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Where is that? Hell. That is a dire warning not to waste your time. Don't bury your talents or assume you have so little talent that God doesn't expect you to study and practice to improve that talent. So when James said, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll do such and such, we'll go to such and such a town and spend a year there and trade to make a profit, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring," we must not jump to the conclusion that he was telling us not to go into business with the goal of, or the expectation of turning a profit. We dare not infer that going to school for to learn a trade or a skill for the sake of earning a living would be wrong. Jesus was clear that we will be held accountable for not doing those types of things. But rather, James's hypothetical statement is intended to get our attention and ask the question of James, well, what do you suggest as a better approach, James? And so James offers this in the next little paragraph, verse 15. You ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Now I could have read those three verses each by themselves, and they would have made perfect sense. But they're all three together. James has been called the Proverbs of the New Testament. And sometimes we approach it like Proverbs, where we can take this verse, and we can memorize this verse, and we can apply this verse, and we can create a whole system of doctrine on this verse. Those of you that have been around me long enough to know that we don't do that here. I don't teach that way. I teach in context. These verses are related. And while each one does have some principles in and of itself, they must be seen as connected. Now, verse 15 is an obvious answer to the implied question. This is how we should approach our future plans. In recognition that we don't know the mind, the will, or the plans of God, which trump our plans, by simply acknowledging that our plans are contingent on what God wills. Of course, just making that statement, as James says here, is not the end all. It's the attitude behind that statement that's important. It's an attitude of submission to the will of God. It's an attitude that recognizes that my own plans are subservient to those of God. It's not a matter of optimism versus pessimism. You can still be optimistic about your plans for the future while giving God the ultimate authority over those plans. That's verse 15. Now, verse 16 may seem less obvious as relating to the topic at hand, at least in our English translations of James's original Greek. But it's a reminder of the error of banking on future plans. The heart of the issue here is pride and arrogance. The warning is not to boast in your abilities and or your plans. Now, James must have had some specific insight into the common practices of some of his intended audience. Perhaps having been successful in the past at moving to a place of great opportunity and making a good living, they felt their accomplishments granted them the right to boast. I've done this before. I went out to Oklahoma when I was 17, 18 years old, and I made an $80,000 in 1 year. Now I'm going to go to Texas and I'm going to do the same thing. I may even make more this time. And while I'm at it, I'm going to shell out some money in the lottery. I think I'm going to win the lottery too. And I'm going to buy this brand new boat. And this great little ATV. And you know what? I think as a man, I need a big truck. And it's got to have the four-wheel drive and the big mud tires and all that great stuff and a great exhaust system so everyone can hear me coming 2 miles down the road. And you know what? Because I have this good job now, I have good credit. And they'll give me that. I mean, I'll go down to the dealership and I can walk away. And of course, they'll have to do some special stuff to it. But I can go down there and I can get that. And I can impress all my friends. You guys are smiling. Have you done that? Have you thought that way before? No. We're not rednecks here. We don't do mud in here. But we all understand that principle. I'm going to go make all kinds of money. And now I'm going to show my friends just how successful I really am. I'm going to boast in that. It's an attitude that ignores, or at least underestimates, the providence of God in one's ventures. Jesus told a parable warning of the danger of not being rich toward God. The context is a warning about coveting and being consumed with more stuff. Now, here's where your Luke 12 comes in. You can go ahead and turn there. The man in the parable reflects an arrogance which leads to selfishness and a failure to consider the source of one's success. Luke 12 records it this way. And Jesus said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable. So Jesus he's just kind of set this up. Here's the topic. Your life does not consist in the abundance of things you have. It doesn't matter if you have that great mudding truck with the big fat tires and a loud exhaust system. Woo-hoo. Doesn't matter. Your life does not consist in those things. And so he tells this parable. He says, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. I have all this money. What am I going to do with all this money?'" Oh, what a terrible problem this is. Well, verse 18. He said, "I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.'" Ah, isn't it nice to finally have arrived? What am I going to do with all that? What a terrible problem this is. But you know what? I have a solution. I need a bigger bank account. This bank will no longer carry my money. I gotta get a bigger bank. I can relax now. I've worked. I've earned this. I've worked hard. I've earned this. This feels good. Just to eat, drink, and be merry. Verse 20. "But God said to him, 'Fool! This night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?'" Not yours. "So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." The man in this parable was obviously consumed with acquiring more stuff. And by the way, I venture a guess that, kind of like the rich man and Lazarus parable that Jesus told, you kind of wonder, did Jesus actually see someone do this? I think maybe he might have. That's conjecture. But this man was consumed with acquiring more stuff. He cared little or nothing about the things of the Lord. He embodies well the attitude of many, quote, good people today who have no time or place for things of the Lord because they're concerned about the physical, secular things of life. There is, at the same time, an air of arrogance in the action of tearing down barns to build bigger ones, like purchasing that nicer car or perhaps a house in the right neighborhood. Maybe a membership to the country club. Or buying the right brand of clothing. That's more our speed. The right brand of clothing. I gotta have those. When I was a teenager, the Nike Air Jordans were the things. I mean, you were cool if you had those. It was a status symbol. So he's got this air of arrogance. Now, there's nothing wrong with doing those things if you can afford them. The problem is that they're nothing more than ways of maintaining an appearance. It's a form of boasting to send a message to people you want to impress that you're doing quite well for yourself. It's very much related to the practice of planning to go off and earn a good sum of money, especially when you begin to purchase things on credit, assuming you'll always have at least that level of income, and perhaps even more. James calls this boasting evil. That's a harsh word. But I think it's a word more Christians need to hear about their actions. Because churches are full of people living like this. Now, of course, not this church. Again, we're always talking about somebody else, right? Churches are full of people that live just like this. They've borrowed against the future, and they've extended their credit to the max, as though they will soon come into a large sum of money. That's the American way. And it's just as much in the church as it is out of the church. Is that not boasting? We keep borrowing money. Yeah, it is feeding the flesh. That is true. But I think there's also an era of I want to appear that I'm just as well off as the next guy. You always want to compete with the Joneses. I'm not sure where that term came from. There's probably some great story behind that. I always have to be better than the Joneses. But it is evil, James calls it. And it's consumed them. And it's hamstrung so many Christians. And by the way, the churches they comprise are also hamstrung. For two reasons. One, because the people who comprise them are so strapped with debt trying to look good that they have nothing left to give, either of themselves or of their resources. And then the second place, the churches they comprise, who are generally run by these same people, have those very same practices. And so for some reason churches are just strapped for money, just like the people who comprise them. Enough of that. Let's go on to verse 17 now. This is all going to tie together here in a minute. When we come to verse 17, we're tempted to deal with it on its own merit. Whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is a sin. Now that's a verse that seems to stand just perfectly fine on its own merit, apart from the principle James is conveying about the admonition of counting on the future. In fact, it's an axiom upon which stands a well-accepted Christian principle of living, that there are sins of what we call sins of omission. Those things we knew we should have done, but we didn't do. It's not sins we committed, per se, that we did wrong and we went against God's law, but we knew we should have done this, and we just didn't do it, for whatever reason. What in the world does that have to do with James' present topic? Think back to Jesus' parable of the talents. The master gave each servant a large sum of money. In fact, some estimate a single talent may have been as much as 20 years' wages for labor. One talent. So the guy that got one talent, if that estimate is correct, 20 years of wages at once from his master. One. That's a lot of money. Multiply that times 2 and times 5 for the second other two servants. The point that Jesus was conveying to his audience about in this parable, that it was a staggeringly large amount of money for each of them. Millions of dollars in our economy. The master was thus portrayed as having almost unfathomable wealth. This wealthy ruler entrusted money to each of these three servants. Now again, it's perhaps difficult for us to imagine such a scenario. Now, some helpful modern retellings of this parable describe the master as a CEO of a large investment firm, and the servants as employees of that firm. They were stock traders, for instance. Now, this is a modern retelling, okay? This is not what was going on. But in our, we can picture this perhaps better. A CEO of a large investment corporation. Now, you're the people on the stock exchange. The reason that's helpful is because it helps us understand why someone would give millions of dollars before leaving with the promise of coming back later. Yes, the amount in the parable is most likely in the amounts of tens of millions of dollars that these folks got. It seems obvious that the employee would know his job was to invest those holdings to gain a return for the CEO, doesn't it? When you think about it in those terms, you automatically understand. You understand, do you not? I mean, if you're thinking in those terms, you understand immediately why each one of those servants got such huge amounts of money. It was assumed that they would invest that money. Without the cultural context of Jesus' listeners and the Gospel's readers, which they fully understood, it's hard for us to imagine a scenario like this. And thus, we may struggle with this third servant, why he was treated so harshly for simply guarding the master's assets. But I want you to notice what you did automatically with this parable without even thinking about it. You wonder, why would the master give the servant millions of dollars in the first place? That why question is important. You did that because you wondered what the master's intent or the master's will was regarding that money. You see, the servants, all three of them, knew exactly what the master's will was regarding what he put in their care. There was no question. The one who hid the talent may well have expected to be able to use that later for himself, should the master not return. I think we generally picture an overly cautious person protecting the money by burying it. But I think we extend far too much grace to that third servant. Perhaps because we see ourselves in that third servant. And perhaps it's because the way Matthew worded it, the servant's response is, "Well, I just was hiding it just in case. You know, I was going to protect it for you." But if you said the words "buried treasure," now I just said those words, what came to mind when I said "buried treasure"? Pirates, maybe? Burying a treasure? Huh. Interesting. Now, did anyone ever make that connection with this parable? Why not? Well, because the guy said, I was afraid. Something might happen to me, so I buried it. And you're a liar. You are a liar. And the master saw right through it, which is why he called him a wicked and slothful servant. You liar! You were hoping I wouldn't come back so you could dig it up. No one's going to miss that little bit of money. I mean, compared to what the other two guys got, the closest guy to him got twice as much. And the next guy got five times as much. In an audit, that little bit this guy buried wouldn't have even hit the radar. He could have dug it up and had it for himself, and no one would have been the wiser. which is why the Master came down so hard on this guy. To this servant, the will of the Master didn't matter at all. He was only concerned about what he could get for himself. The two servants in Jesus' parable who immediately went to work, improving upon what their master had given them, did so because they knew that was beyond a shadow of a doubt what their master willed. It was implicit in the fact that he entrusted them with those talents, those huge amounts of money. The third servant also knew what the master's will was regarding the talents. As James says, he knew the right thing to do, and he failed to do it. Thus, for him, it was sin, and he was punished for it. So if the first warning James gives is not to boast in your abilities and or plans to make great achievements, the second warning is against the other extreme of doing nothing at all. James calls one evil, and he calls the other sin. Both have the same effect of robbing God. The first robs God of the glory due him by boasting of the talents and success that came by God's hand, but taking that credit for myself. The second robs God by failing to develop the talents, time, and money he's entrusted to your care into things useful for his kingdom. Like the servants entrusted with the master's money, you don't have to ask if it's God's will for you to do something with what he's given you. The implicit answer for the believer in Jesus Christ is that he did give you gifts, which he intends for you not only to use, but also to hone and to become more proficient using. That is a given. And there are many Christians who have fallen into the habit of laziness. And COVID has made that even easier than ever, as many have validated that habit with the justification of, I'm just trying to stay safe, lay low, I want to stay out of circulation. Way you can stay out of circulation and not be lazy. I'll pick on Dottie Hoppe today. Dottie Hoppe, she finally was able to come back to church not too long ago. For a year, she was not in church. Was Dottie Hoppe, the missionary we support, doing nothing? No. Not a chance in the world. She did not use COVID as an excuse to, I'll sit back, eat, drink, and be merry. She was still active, though unseen. You know, there are plenty of good Christians in the world who avoid committing sins. They don't hurt people. They don't lie. They don't steal. They don't cheat. They don't do drugs. At the same time, having done little or nothing for Christ with a talent, time, or tithe God gave them, they have, in effect, said, this is really my talent and my time and my money. I will use it for my own benefit first. Now, some might justify and say, well, if there's something left over, I'll give it to God. But, you know, times are tough. And so there's rarely anything really left over. You just don't understand how busy I am and how much financial responsibilities I've got. And you just, there's probably not going to be much left for God to get when I'm done with this. God just hasn't given me enough. If I had 10 talents like that guy up there, then I would do something. I only have one. So, what can I do? I think I'll hang on to this. Because you never know, I might need it. And they never consider the will of the one they say is their master. This failing to do the right thing, James says, is sin. Now, the one who boasts about the money or things he has acquired through his own efforts commits an equally offensive evil. Now, he may have used those talents invested that money or used that time in ways that brought gains, resulting in the acquisition of many nice things to keep up appearances. But this being a form of boasting is evil. You need to consider carefully James's admonition that since you don't know what tomorrow will bring, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. That means that you need to ask regularly the question, what is the Lord's will for this? What is the Lord's will for the things that He has put into my care? Because they're His. They're not yours. That talent that you've got, whether it's 1, 5, or 10, it's not yours. It's God's. That money you've got, whether it's a few pennies or hundreds of thousands of dollars, it's not yours. It's God's. And He has entrusted it to your care. And the question should be, what is the Lord's will regarding this? Which may be a little bit of a twisting of how James puts the question. What is the Lord's will? The short answer is that He expects you to invest it. If you're not investing it, the only other option is you're stealing it. You catch that? That third servant, what did he do? He didn't invest it. What did he do? He buried it. He stole it. He stole it from the master because he expected it would be his. He was going to get the leftovers, not the master. Because the master may not return. And I'll have that talent for myself. And I can buy nice things and do nice things and have lots of fun. Eat, drink, and be merry. Build bigger barns. You wicked and slothful servant. You will be cast into outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Because you're not investing that money, that talent, that time. You're stealing it from God. My question, James's question, Jesus' question is, are you investing what God has given you, or are you stealing it? Those are your two options. I would challenge you to right now start investing it. Dig it out and start investing it. It's not too late. But when the master comes and all you've done is buried it and done nothing with it, then it's too late. Oh, but God, I didn't have very much. What could I do? I couldn't. I didn't have enough time. I didn't have money. God, you didn't give me enough. I needed more. But you weren't faithful with the little bit He did give you. Don't ever expect more if you're not faithful in those little things. Start investing now. Let's pray. God, we thank You for Your word. Thank You, Lord, for the words of James, which parallel so well and tie in so perfectly with the parables of Jesus. They remind us that though we don't know what tomorrow holds and our life is a vapor, that is not an excuse nor a reason to not plan for the future, to not invest in the future, to not look to the future. God, I pray for each person in this room. Pray for the young people especially, Lord, who still have, we think, so much of their lives before them. That they would not waste these young years. Or for those who are older, who may look back and, as we talked about in Sunday school today, may think, well, I'm too old to do anything now. What can I do? Thank You for the example of Abraham we read in Genesis, who in his 70s was called and left his home with his family and all of his goods and all his possessions and walked thousands of miles to a land you said only that you would show him. God, may we not excuse ourselves from your service because we think we don't have much. We're too old, we're too young, we're not smart enough, we don't have enough money, we don't have enough time. God, open our eyes to the places you would have us to serve. Lord, this week as we have this crusade opportunity here in Ashflat, thank you for those you have led to organize this thing. And pray your hand on those men who are teaching, preaching, sharing the gospel. Pray your hand on those who are sharing music and other things during that time. And God, may we be stewards of the opportunities you give us to interact with those around us, even to invite them and even take them to these services. God, we ask that you would bless that we would see a return on that investment. That we would see lives changed by the gospel, because that's what it does. May that work begin in our own hearts, Lord, even today. Lord, I pray for those who may be feeling conviction right now because they realize that they have buried that talent, whether it's money, time, talents, or other things. They refuse to use those things for your glory and your kingdom. Lord, that you would bring conviction, that they would begin to look for places to invest those things. That we would not bury the things you've given to us to invest in your kingdom's work. And that we would see them multiply. Lord, I pray for the church congregational meeting that's coming up here in a little bit. Lord, as we as a church look to invest in the future, that we would not be so gripped with fear of what could be, that we hold on to the things you've entrusted to our care as a church. May we invest wisely, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.